Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thong, Earthlets around the world, and welcome to another edition of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am Molchar, publicity droid for 2000 AD, and I'm going to start off with a thank you. Yet again, the feedback and the support for the Thrillcast has been absolutely fantastic over the last couple of months. So thank you to every single person who's not only listened, but also spread the word. For those of you who've not listened to the Thrillcast before, we are going through the first issues of the Judge Dredd Mega Collection, which is a new collection available from all good newsagents in the UK and Ireland, published by Hachette Partworks and 2000 AD, which aims to bring you the best Judge Dredd stories from 2000 AD and Judge Dredd magazine, chronicling the best adventures of the Lawman of the Future, Joe Dredd. And now, in previous episodes, we have concentrated on stories such as Shambhala with Judge Anderson, The Apocalypse War, America, one of the all-time seminal stories of 2018. And this week, we are moving on to Mandroid by John Wagner and Kev Walker, with additional stories by Simon Colby and Carl Critchlow. Now, this is a bit of a dark one, and it's a very morally complex and quite challenging story. So we're going to be moving on to that in a minute. In the meantime, for those of you who aren't reading 2000 AD at the moment, I thought I'd just take a little bit of your time just to explain that this week, the edition that is out this very Wednesday, is the perfect starting point for new and lapsed readers. Prog 1924, which is available from all good newsagents, from all good comic book stores. It's available digitally, DRM-free, through our webshop at 2000adonline.com. And it is also available through our iPad and Android apps. This issue has five brand new stories, including Judge Dredd, but also some classic favourites like Slain and Strontium Dog, along with Orlok the Assassin, Agent of East Meg 1, and Grey Area by Dan Abnett and Mark Harrison. The point of our jumping on issues is that it is the ideal time, if you've ever thought about reading 2000 AD, to jump on board. To start reading, everything starts at the same time, so you're not coming in mid-story, so it won't be too confusing. And in this particular jumping on issue, we have added four extra pages in order to give you a little bit of backstory. Each story has a synopsis of its own, so that you won't be left behind. Like I said, it's available in print and online and through our app. So I really do encourage you to give it a go. It's an absolutely incredible issue. Obviously, we get to see these stories in advance in the 2018 Nerve Center. And the forthcoming stories are absolutely wonderful examples of British comics at their absolute best. So I encourage you to give 2000 AD a go. Start reading now. You really won't regret it. I've been reading since I was a kid, and it was probably the best decision I ever made. Now, moving on to the Judge Dredd Mega Collection, the edition that's out this week, which is Mandroid. Now, Mandroid, like I said, it's quite a dark and morally complex story. Sergeant Nate Slaughterhouse is a veteran of many of the campaigns on alien worlds, because humanity has moved out to the stars in Judge Dredd's world. He is half the man he was, quite literally. He comes back to Mega City 1 with horrific injuries, and half his body is replaced by cybernetic implants. And he becomes a mandroid, hence the title of the story. But discharged from the army, he returns to Mega City 1 and really does struggle, along with his family, to adapt to this new existence, this slightly more mundane existence. Well, I say mundane. Almost immediately, the darker side of Mega City 1 sees fresh meat, and they find themselves subject to vicious and bitter attacks from the criminal underworld. The judges are unable to help, but Dredd senses something within Nate Slaughterhouse. He understands perhaps the conclusion of the story just as it begins, and warns Nate not to take the law into his own hands. But it's a morally complex story. Nate is, I think, a veteran that many people will understand, not just from fiction, but also possibly in their own lives, where the injustice of daily life can really get to someone who has sacrificed so much. Now, I'm not going to spoil the story for you because it is an absolute treat and probably one of John Wagner's darker and more intense stories. So I do encourage you to pick up the Judge Dredd Mega Collection edition of Mandroid. It's also available from 2000ADonline.com through our online shop. But this week, I'm very pleased that one of the original creative team on Mandroid is here to talk to us. Joining us on the phone from Sheffield is legendary 2080 artist Kev Walker. Thanks for joining us on the 2080 Throwcast, Kev.
No problem at all.
We'll crack on straight with the questions. Let's talk a bit about how you came to be working on 2000 AD in the first place, because your early time on the comic was inking Steve Dillon on Harlem Heroes and Rogue Trooper on Cinnabar. Was this what you had aimed to do, or was this a case of editorial at the time getting new experience by working alongside somebody like Steve?
Well, that was actually what it was. I got my first try out doing a few Thugs, Future Shocks and stuff like that. I think the editor at the time, Richard Burton, thought I needed just a bit of traineeship. I was to do with storytelling and,
right.
And things like that. And inking someone like Steve Dillon was probably one of the best ways to go about it. I'd done the first few stories based on the back of some illustrations I'd done and sent in purely on spec, and they tried me out, and I'd never really tried. I could kind of draw, but I'd never really been told shown how to tell a story visually. So that was the important thing for him at the time. And of course, to just practice figure work and things like that. I could draw robots like nothing, but no problem. But drawing people's a different matter.
you mentioned Steve Dillon being the ideal person to serve your apprenticeship with, because by that point he was an absolute powerhouse, wasn't he? In 2000.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think was the key thing that Steve taught you about storytelling, about drawing comics?
One of the things that is there's lots of things like the way the flow of panels, you know, from close ups and starting off with establishing shots and things like that to set your scene, and just keeping in mind where your character is in 3D space in a particular room. It's one of those things that's really easy to forget if you can just forget that your characters are actually in a place, and unless you have them moving, there's no need for they shouldn't be seen to be changing locations. So that was one of the weird things to get my head around at the time. And he was very good at establishing a place and putting the people in it and actually having them act within that setting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You went from inking Steve Dillon and as you say, the Future Shocks. But then when you kind of had your own stab at it after this apprenticeship, your style was very radically different, because up until that point you'd been working in black and white, and then we come on to the ABC Warriors stuff in the early 90s, and all of a sudden you are fully painting these glorious pages. How did that happen as a process?
that was me trying to big myself up. I actually went down to the office once with Steve. I met up with Steve Dillon. Went down there. We were taking some Harlem Heroes pages in.
Yeah.
And we just met up because he happened to be in London around the same time. And we met up, and we both went in, and they had some of Simon Bisley's first painted pages from
Slaying the Horn God, yeah.
Yeah, and everybody was sort of fawning over them and going, "Oh, look at this! Oh, look at, you know, we're not worthy," and bowing on bended knee kind of thing as everybody did. And I went, "I can paint. And at this point, I'd never really picked up any. I'd done some stuff painted in gouache, but nothing like what they're asking to. And when Richard Burton actually turned round and said, "Okay, we'll try you out," and he gave me a rug, because I'd been working on, I'd done the Rogue Trooper stuff with Steve. So he gave me a one-off for the annual to try me out in paint. And I realised I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But it obviously impressed him enough that I was trying really hard. So he tried me out, on ABC Warriors.
Right. Because I remember reading that as a youngster, and when ABC Warriors started, I was blown away. You know, obviously I'd seen painted artwork before, but it felt so accomplished and so rich that I think as a kid who didn't really know how comics were produced at the time, it really felt as if, you know, you'd been doing it like that for ages. But I mean, that's a remarkably, like I said, rich and complex style to just kind of suddenly launch into.
Well, I mean, there's two things. First of all, I wasn't really trained out in paint. I wasn't really shown out of paint.
Mm.
When I went to art college years before, I did graphics, so basically messing around with felt tips and tracing pictures of tractors for adverts, things like that. All of which by 1983 became completely irrelevant because the desktop publishing thing happened. You know, so yeah. Like the moment I left college, everything that I'd learned at college was worthless. And for 4 years after that, I did packaging, which was painting fruit in gouache and on the sides of yogurt pots and. Yeah. Doing board games, when I tackled the paint, I had the paints and I knew I had some of the skills, but I came from a different place to Simon, because the things that I was into were people like Chris Foss. Chris Moore, people like that, who were doing the science fiction book covers at the time.
Yeah,
they were kind of like my heroes at the time, and I wanted to be able to paint like them. So that when it came to doing that, especially the first episode of ABC Warriors, I had there was a bit of a learning curve, just learning how to use a paint, because apart from the Rogue Trooper story, I'd never really used acrylics.
Mm.
But I'd actually found out that that's what Simon was using, because some of the stuff I knew that there was no way you could do it using gouache, and I wanted to know what he was using. So I found out that he used acrylic, so I went out and bought some, and it was a learning curve. When you buy something like that new and you've never used it before, there's just a steep learning curve, learning what the material can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea. So I was actually, with ABC Warriors, I knew the images I wanted. I just didn't know how to arrive at them. It was a bit of a learning curve. That first book of Chronicles of Chaos is basically me learning on the page for everybody to see.
well done. It's a remarkable learning curve.
I managed to convince the editors at the time that I knew what I was doing.
Brilliant.
Rather than just making it up as I went along.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier about being able to draw robots really well, but finding it difficult with people. You went from ABC Warriors onto the Judge Anderson story, Childhood's End, when she goes off to Mars.
That's right, yeah.
And the first
episode of that, that really told me how little I knew how to draw people.
Brilliant.
Yeah. By the time I got to the last sort of two episodes of Anderson, things were starting to click into place.
Yeah.
The way I was painting, I think you can see there's from the beginning to the end of that, there's a quite dramatic change in the way I'm painting.
Mm.
And that certainly shows on the next book of ABC Warriors, which came out of the Hellbringer stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I wanted to just chat about your painted stuff was because then when you came on to Dread later, your style had radically changed again.
Well, it changed a couple of times.
Right.
I'd done Balls Brothers.
Yes.
Which was kind of a labour of love for me. I put so much into that book, into that story. It was cross-hatched to the nth degree. I did every single bit of detail you could possibly cram. I just wanted everything to be in there because I really liked the characters. I liked the idea of superheroes being idiots and it was like succeeding despite themselves.
Yeah.
To be fair, nobody else really was. I was so depressed about that because I'd poured everything I had into that story.
Mm.
And cynically, I just thought I was really into Mike Mignola's work on Hellboy at the time.
Yeah.
And I saw that and I thought, oh hell, if he can get away with drawing very little on the page, so can I. It sounds cynical, but I had a go at it. I did a Mean Machine story, and I found out it was a lot harder than it looked.
Exactly.
You actually have to design things right. You can't get away with hiding things behind rubble and which I was doing on Balls Brothers. You actually have to draw.
Yeah.
You actually have to design, and that was what I learned on the Mean Machine, and that went straight into other things I was doing. I did Sin City directly before Mandroid, and then I went on to Mandroid. Mm. By that time, I'd got that style sorted out.
Yeah, it's often the thing you hear from people that they describe Mignola as having a very simple style, and you think, well, you try and copy it then, because it's actually incredibly multi-layered and complex the way that he does his pages.
He can draw that way because it's the experience of a lifetime being really good.
Absolutely.
That allows him to be that simple and get away with it.
Mm.
And I didn't know that when I was starting out, but I learned it quite quickly.
You mentioned Sin City there, which is going to be reprinted later in the Judge Dredd Mega Collection. Opening page, episode page, began with the same page layout?
Yeah.
I mean, do you like to give your stories kind of recurring visual themes and motifs?
That was just one of the things I wanted to do. I like strips that are stories that have title pages,
mm.
or if you want to call it in graphic novel terms, chapter pages. because you're starting off, and if you're starting off on a tiny little sequence of panels, it's kind of like you're entering to the middle of something that's already been. It feels like you're missing something.
Mm.
I loved all those early Dredd stories back in the 70s when they actually the first panel had to have the logo in it, and I wanted to kind of hark back to that, and that's kind of like a little homage to the Mike Mignola and Carlos Esquerra days when you always start off with a title panel, which is just kind of just scene setting, really.
Yeah, well, it's something that I touched on in the article in the back of a forthcoming edition of the Mega Collection, which is Judge Anderson, The Possessed, which was drawn by Brett Ewins. And you notice that the cliffhanger image of each episode is pretty much the same as the opening image of the following episode. And it's kind of like this really heightened moment, like this blockbuster kind of ta-da, you know, keep you on tenterhooks for a week, and then you come back in and you go back into the story. And that's a really, well, particularly when you're dealing with weekly comics, that's a really effective storytelling technique.
One of the other things about Sin City was as well is that John was actually writing that as I was drawing it,
right.
Although he had the, you know, the main story arc in his mind, the actual details of how you're going to get from not from A to Z, but from A to B, C to D,
mm.
all the way down. He was tinkering with that as he was going along, and he was writing an episode based on the one I'd done sort of like 2 weeks before or whatever. And he actually did say that if it would have been a different story if it was going to draw it.
Yeah.
He would have done things differently.
Mm.
I don't want to put words in John's mouth at all, but maybe that was one of the things that he worked into Mandroid, because when I got Mandroid, that story was so thoroughly worked out from beginning to end that I could just go away with it. And I knew where I was going. I knew what I was building up to, so that I could allude to lots of things when I was doing the early pages.
Mm. Well, you've worked almost exclusively with John Wagner on your Dread stories for 2000 AD. Do you think John's scripts bring out your best work? What is it about them that you enjoy?
I think John's just a very very good writer for an artist, because he just tells the story and lets the artist do their thing. He doesn't bother himself so much with camera angles and the amount of dialogue. He's sometimes kind of loose, because he knows he can go back and tweak it, you know, add things or take things away if he needs more room as he wants. So he's just a really easy person to work with.
Mm.
And that, again, that comes from experience as well.
Yeah.
Knowing, just being not so precious over the work that you can't allow someone else to do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the way we, as an artist, I have to be with to allow another colorist to come along and. Although with Sin City and Mandroid, I was colouring myself, but on other things, I have to allow a colourist to do their thing as well.
Yeah, we do hear that a lot from artists is how much they enjoy working with John, just because of the freedom and the trust that's placed in them to kind of say, well, here's the bare bones, here's the script, you go away and play with it, and you know it's a test almost. To how that artist is going to react to that, because you know, some people kind of look at it and go, "Well, what am I meant to do?" Whereas, you know,
I think it kind of depends on the artist as well. I think there's, because I had worked on, when it came to my Dread work, I'd worked exclusively with John. He probably kind of knew what he was by the time I got to Mandroid. He knew what he was going to get from me, so he knew that he could just leave. Leave certain things alone. It didn't have to, tell me whether it was a high angle or, you know, unless it was actually for a specific plot point that he wanted to get across. It just leave me to it, and I think that just came from having worked together for a couple of very big stories. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've kind of skirted around Mandroid a little bit, but let's kind of plunge into that. It's an incredibly dark and uncompromising storyline about Nate Slaughterhouse and his family. How did you feel about the story when you first got those scripts?
It was just one of the it just reminded me of one of those. The thing about John is brilliant, absolutely brilliant at doing pathos.
Yeah,
he can get to the kernel. So if something is, he can write the saddest story imaginable. Can John?
Mm.
He can not also write the most lunatic stories as well. But I don't like it. Like a lot of writers can't do sadness like that. And he's kind of like that kind of desperate. I mean, there's a guy who loses absolutely everything. He loses his family. He loses half his body. Mm. And he ends up in prison at the end of it. I mean, if he ends up in a cube, if ever there was a man who was like, okay, we'll let you go.
Yeah.
he deserved that kind of, well, I'll just turn a blind eye to you because you've just wiped out all the bad guys.
Yeah.
He deserved it, but he still, by the end of my story, he ends up in prison. And he's kind of like, it's just like, that's one of those things where you know, you're rooting for the bad guy, essentially.
Yeah. And in terms of how you reacted to that story through your art, do you feel that that pathos, that darkness, that difficult moral situation, how did you rise to that?
Well, I actually I made a point, it was a very because the story felt very very hard. I wanted the line work to be very hard as well, because it was a very grim, cold, black and white story. There was I did even less shading and texturing that than I'd done previously, and I actually used rapidographs on that, the steel pointed pens rather than felt tips.
Oh right, okay.
And I drew it on really thick tracing paper because it's a really hard surface to draw on.
Yeah.
And I think I still got most of those pages somewhere.
Right.
And so I penciled it on a separate sheet and then just traced it through for the line work, just to get that really hard. It's just the like concrete edge feel to it. It's all clean and cold. It's a hard thing to go, but that's just where it felt like it needed to make. The scene where Nate Slaughterhouse loses his son, because it's the cliffhanger of an episode, and goes over the beginning, the end of one episode, the beginning of another. And that I still think that's one of the best scenes I've ever drawn.
Right.
I actually found myself crying while I was drawing it.
Oh, wow.
And I was just thinking, Jesus, I didn't really realise that I could do something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably because I think at the time I'd become a father, so that's probably why I did that.
Mm.
But that was actually a really hard story to draw, so that part of it anyway.
Because I find rereading it that you are very quickly drawn into the situation that the slaughterhouses are in, this kind of dizzying, confusing situation that they're never ahead of. You know, as soon as one thing happens, something else.
Yeah. Everything is completely out of their control. It doesn't matter what they do. Things just spiral out of control, and there is nothing they can do about it. It's kind of it's like being in the middle of a riot.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you do. Everything's out of your control, and it's just about being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, John writes a lot of things like that, going all the way back to the early days when Steve Dillon did a story which was Alone in the Crowd, which was just a one-off story about people not wanting to be distracted while someone else is being mugged on a city street and everybody else turning a blind eye. And that's one of the recurring things that John writes about, how it's such a massive place is Megacity, and with so many people, yet every single person that lives there is alone, and never gets any help, even from the people that are supposed to give them help.
Yeah, we've talked on the Thrillcast before about the moral ambiguity inherent in Dredd, and how John has really played up the elements of that ambiguity over the years. And as you say, Mandroid is such a difficult story because under any other writer, you would end up with everything being okay. You know, Nate's wife it isn't quite the same, but Nate's okay, you know, and yes, life's going to be difficult, but we're going to get through it together. And John just doesn't pull that punch at all. He destroys this poor man who's done nothing but want to live in peace, and all the way through, Dredd is sympathetic, but
that's right, yeah.
But harsh,
yeah. And I think it would have been very easy. I'm quite sure that John knew there was going to be another story, which because he could quite easily just just finished it there and then and killed Nate, Slaughterhouse off. Mm. But there was more to be told, because there were still a few open threads, like, you know, what are you going to do with his wife? Because she's basically like a robot vegetable.
Mm.
Because she's had a brain messed about with at the end, so she doesn't she's not in there anymore. And I think there was still some other things. The whole war veterans thing was you know, what do you do when you've been trained to fight and you're not allowed to do the thing that you've been trained to? And all those questions were there to be answered, which is why I think there was. And it was. I actually wanted to do the sequel as well. I think at the time when I got the call saying, "Well, we want to do Mandroid 2," I just accepted a big job from either Marvel or DC at the time, so right. There was just no way I could do it.
Mm. Let's talk about your colouring on Mandroid, because I think it's probably as distinctive as the style in which you're drawing the strip in with pencils and inks. How do you settle on a colour palette for something like Mandroid? Because everything felt very dour, very dirty.
Yeah, that was me trying to. You got to try and tell the emotions of the story through because you don't have. You don't have sound and music and whatever. All you've got is lines and colour.
Mm.
So you've got to use the colour to give the story its emotional pitch. And if everything's bleak, then you've got to have bleak colours. There's no point in making it all nice and jolly if it's one of the really sad part of the story.
Mm.
The colour is there to tell the emotions of the characters, not just, you know, concrete's grey, sky's blue, things like that. That's not what it's there for. The colours of the city and, you know, Mega City 1 are there to reflect the people in it. And if they're having a happy time, the colours of the city and everything around them are happy. And if they're not, then the colours aren't.
Mm.
And actually, that's kind of my philosophy for the way comics should be coloured. Anyway,
right.
I think if you start with using every crayon in the box from the beginning, you've nowhere to go.
Mm.
You've got to be able to build up to your big explosion, because if you start off with those colours, nobody's going to notice it by the time you get to the end, because it'll be drowned out by all the previous scenes.
Mm.
So you've got to, if you're building up to a climax, you've got to start off bleak so that the bright colours will show that acceleration in tone.
Mm. Mm. It's interesting with colouring that it's kind of one of those not forgotten but kind of passed over arts where if it's working, you don't notice it, you know.
That's right. Yeah, it's a very very underrated thing, and so little is. Colour is kind of like an afterthought for a lot of comics, and it can either elevate or completely ruin a piece of line work.
Mm.
It's the thing that people tend not to notice quite as much, and people who do it a lot over just the colouring over people like Chris Bly tend to can sometimes be maligned, but they turn colours out. Every day, and sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong.
Yeah.
More often than not, people like Chris Blythe get it right. He's a very good colorist, and they do it on such a small page rate that the fact that there's any color on there should be applauded. it's part of the way comics works. If the margins were better, if people bought more comics, then maybe they could pay more for certain things like lettering and colouring. Because lettering is another place where it can completely ruin. And you know, the number of times where it happens actually in a couple of places in the Dread story that's already been published, the Origins story.
Yeah,
is that a speech bubble ends up. Speech balloon ends up being placed directly over the thing that people are talking about, so you can't see it.
Yeah.
And well, I left that space to the left of the character for the speech balloon, and you put it on the right where the thing is talking about it. It's like little things, and it completely spoils the flow of the story. And putting a comic strip together is so much a collaboration of people that the person who's reading it sometimes forgets that it's not just the editorial staff and everything else as well, that if all those people, if something just doesn't gel quite together, then the story's ruined. But they don't see them. They just go, "Oh, that's not a good strip," or "That's a bad strip." It works. And they don't realize understand why. And it's sort of quite often little things that can ruin a story.
Let's talk about the one time that you've you wrote and illustrated a comic strip, which was The Inspector, which was is going to be coming up in volume 17 of the Mega Collection.
That's going to be it.
Why did you want to make the leap into scripting, and did you find it more fulfilling, or was it more complex, or?
Writing is one of those things I still want to do.
Yeah.
I'm a better drawer than I am a writer. The writing's actually harder. Nowadays mostly I leave it to other people. I'd wanted to be a writer as well. I had the creative urge. I wanted to create something of my own. That was it. It was just like it was the creative impulse. That's all it was. That's why I created the character. Came with the character. It was just an idea I had, and I pitched it. And I think it was Dave Bishop at the time. Said yes.
Right.
Go ahead and write it up. And it wasn't an easy thing. I worked in collaboration with another guy called Jim Campbell, and he helped me put I had the story ideas, but not the practical experience to be able to lay it all out and work the story out. But it has stood me in good stead. And I think every artist should actually certainly have a go at writing their own stories, because it helps you understand the structure of the thing that you're putting together, what the beat points are, and where the highs and lows go in, where the story works structurally. And you should certainly have a go at putting that together, because actually doing that from starting with nothing, and actually creating the story and then drawing it, it's a different beast altogether than what it is when you're just taking someone else's story. Because so much of it then is already laid out for you.
Okay. Tell us something of your experience working on the 1995 Stallone Judge Dredd film.
Oh no! Yeah. argument time.
All right.
I was meant to be working 2 weeks, and it had been 3 months.
Right.
I was there basically to. Well, it started off. I was there to sell the concept of the film. You know, just the high point, the way the film was kind of gonna look. Most of the work I did was ended up not being in the film, but gave the flavour for all the other artists
right.
I was working on. And it was also to sell a lot of the ideas that Danny Cannon, the director, had, that he wanted to sell to the producers on. And it was an especially difficult. And this is kind of going back to the comics thing, where you've got lots of contributors. Producing that film was a lot harder than a lot of people realise, because there were essentially 5 producers on that film.
Wow.
And I spoke to most of them briefly, in some cases. But the every single one of those producers who were convinced they were, or told me what that they were making, what kind of film they were making,
right.
And each one had a different idea of the film they were making. So the fact that it even got actually filming was a minor miracle, really.
Right.
And I think Danny Cannon did the best he could at the time with the people. I mean, because he can put a story together. I mean, as a director, he's pretty much right up there as far as TV's concerned. He was one of the creating starting directors on CSI. He created the franchise. He started off Gotham, the recent Batman prequel thing. So he knows how to put a story together. I just think that it's when you trying to bring so many elements that are working together, you're fighting a hard battle.
Yeah. Because I think the Stallone movie is often maligned. I know I've done it many a time because of various elements. You know, the helmets came off. There was a kiss at the end, etc.
It is much maligned. Yes.
Yeah, I think it's telling that for all of the criticism of the Stallone film. You know, there were 2000 AD artists like yourself and Chris Cunningham as well was involved. You know, you were the guys who knew what you were about. You know what you were doing. You know how things were meant to look. And I think a lot of times people don't realize that people who worked on 2000 AD were directly involved in the look of the film.
Yes, we were all there and we were all doing our thing. We were fighting for tooth and nail to get things. And, you know, when I was listening in on rewriting conversations. I let out a cry of horror when they said that Dredd was going to kiss Hershey or Hershey was going to kiss Dredd. I was, no, you can't do that. And the editor, the director, to his credit, he walked past me and went, "Kev, I don't want to hear it," shaking his head because he didn't want it either. But you know, there are certain things that are required of a blockbuster, or they were at the time. And the argument was that everybody knew what Stallone looked like because, you know, stars were stars. We hadn't had films like V for Vendetta, where a big name star will actually leave a mask over his face for the entire time. These were the days when it was the star that sold the film. And the thing is that if it hadn't had someone like Stallone, it wouldn't have got the budget, so it wouldn't have been made.
Yeah.
It was a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
And there was some things were going to happen right, some things were going to happen wrong. And it was kind of a toss-up as to whether it was going to work. And I think there's as much works in the film as doesn't.
Mm.
I think the scenes that you can see that I still have had a finger in, which is to do with the robot and the way the city looks.
Yeah.
I'm quite happy to say that they still look great. When it comes to the Dredd outfit, I had nothing to do with the Dredd's uniform. I had nothing to do with the clones. I had nothing to do. And that's another thing that a lot of people don't realise as well. There's the scene in the Dredd film where they're talking about clones, and then all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, everything seems to be exploding.
Yeah,
that's because they had to edit the film to be able to get the PG-13 rating.
Mm.
At the time, the American senator Bob Dole was really big on gun. Abuse in movies.
Yeah,
and so although other films were very very similar, because this was being aimed at young to mid teens, the age group, the gunplay, especially because all the scenes were filmed with them shooting clones.
Mm.
And they couldn't use, they edited them out because they were told to get the law certificate.
Right.
They still didn't get the law certificate, and they couldn't put the footage back in. So somewhere in the production company vaults, there are all of those scenes are sitting there waiting to be put back in a proper director's cut, and it will never happen.
Yeah, that's a shame. I think even when I was how old was I in? I think I was sort of 15, 16 at the time. I thought, where have the clones gone? Why, you say, why is everything exploding all of a sudden? Very bizarre.
So because lots of things got deleted, you're left with lots of times that Dredd's being saved from being shot in the back.
Right.
Which everybody goes, that doesn't make any sense. That would never happen to Dredd. But that's because all the other stuff that was taken out made it look like that's the only bit of story that was left. So it was basically butchered before and after.
Right, right.
But everybody working on it had all the best intentions. Even Stallone himself had the best of intentions. But sometimes things just don't work, no matter how much money you throw at them.
Absolutely, absolutely. So obviously, you've a lot of your career has been spent working on Judge Dredd as a character. Any plans to come back and do more for 2080?
I'd love to come back and do some more. I'm on contract with Marvel, and the way I look at it, I'm kind of spreading 2080-ness to the Americans. So I try to do. Everything, all the characters tend to be a little non-superhero. Nobody wears spandex when I draw them. they all wear proper clothing, and the girls are proper shapes. I try to spread that kind of design, 2000 AD design ethic of big guns and bikes.
Well, there is that character you had a little while ago who looked an awful lot like Judge Dredd.
Yeah, that was intentional.
Yeah, yeah.
When I started work on Thunderbolts, because the writer, Jeff, said he wanted... he asked me what I wanted to do, and I gave him a long list of the things that I would like to see in there. And bless him, he actually put most of them in there.
Right.
And one of his suggestions was because he wanted to put some. He actually wanted to put Judge Dredd. He would have done a proper team up and got Dredd in there if he could have done.
Mm.
But it ended up being a pale homage to Judge Dredd rather than. rather than the actual character himself.
Yeah.
I had to do several designs, and each design, it started off being quite a lot like Dredd and ended up being very little like Dredd. I managed to keep the grimace. That was about it.
Right, excellent. Yeah, it didn't go unnoticed amongst our readership, I think. A lot of people pointed it out, but no, that's great.
Well, that was intended from the very start of me working on that book. I had to wait 2 years to get to that.
Right, blimey. So, Kev, we've run out of time, so thanks very much indeed for joining us on the 2080 Thrillcast.
No problem, anytime.
Brilliant. Thanks again. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our chat with Kev Walker there, and thanks to him for being so very generous with his time. Like we've said, Judge Dredd Mega Collection Mandroid is out in all good newsagents in the UK and Ireland now. If you want to read the story but don't have access to the collection, then there is a digital edition available through the 2080online.com webshop, and I believe it's also available through our apps. Once again, thank you so much for all your support and words of praise for the Thrillcast. We will be continuing, but change is in the air. The next edition will be something a little different. One of the things lots of people have been asking is, what about for those of us who aren't collecting the Judge Dredd Mega Collection? And from the very beginning of this podcast, I was very... keen to open it up after a little while once everything had bedded in. So the next edition will be will have a much wider 2080 focus. So we'll be looking at what's happening in the prog. and also the Judge Dredd magazine. And we've got some nice interviews lined up for that, and we're going to be talking to one or two people about the jumping on issue from this week and how they reacted to it. So it should be an absolutely fascinating one. It is going to be moving to a monthly schedule, so we'll no longer be fortnightly, we'll be moving to monthly, but in between each issue of the 2080 Thrillcast we will be having nice little supplemental episodes which I hope you will really enjoy, whether you're a brand new reader or a reader for a very, very long time. So again, thank you very much indeed for all your support for the Thrillcast. If you've got any feedback whatsoever, whether it's questions, whether it's suggestions, or whether it's just to say whether you love it or hate it, then please do drop us a line at press@2080online.com. All questions, as far as we can, will be answered on our new monthly show. So thanks very much indeed for listening, Earthlets, and see you in a month. Splundig Verthrig!